Well, we're going to see something that might not be as readily apparent in some books of the Bible as they are in others. We're going to see the gospel in a book that some people say, why is that book even in the Bible? Because it has no mention of the gospel or of Jesus Christ or that sort of thing. But we're going to see the gospel in the book of Ruth today. And it seems a very appropriate book, I think, to be talking about on Mother's Day. Now, I had a friend, so I still have a friend, he's still my friend. I have a friend who goes to great lengths not to have any information before he goes to see a movie. If somebody starts to tell him a little bit about that, he'll say, shh, don't tell me. I don't want to know. And if a spoiler alert comes up because of a preview on the television, he'll shut the thing off or he'll go in the other room. I mean, he's almost paranoid about seeing anything. But he says, I want to see it with fresh eyes. And he says, and another thing they do is, in some of these trailers, they'll edit them in a weird way so that it appears that you know what's going to happen and they're misdirecting you, you know, the old sleight of hand trick. And then you go, wait a minute, it didn't go that way like it did in the trailer. What are they doing? So he just doesn't want any spoiler alerts. So I'm about to give you a spoiler alert. I'm going to be like that guy in the movie theater that as he sees the long line of people getting ready to go into the movie, he'll holler out some spoiler alert because he's a nuisance that way. Like, if it was the movie Pompeii, he would say, hey, y'all, they all die. Because, I mean, it's a volcano movie. Come on. Or if it was Apollo 13, he'd say, don't get alarmed. They all make it back safely. Yeah, well, thanks for that guy. But I'm going to give you the spoiler alert. But when I give you the spoiler alert, if you're one of those people like my friend, you just want to put your fingers in your ear and not hear it, and then I will give you a visual signal when you can take them back out again, because you wouldn't hear me if I said you can take your fingers out now. So here's the spoiler alert. You ready? God heals Naomi and Ruth. God heals Naomi and Ruth by giving them what they need, a family. And he heals Israel by giving them what they need. And through one of Ruth's descendants, God gives us what we need. Okay, you can take your fingers out if you didn't want that spoiler alert. Here's some background to Ruth's story. It's an amazing story. The story starts with Naomi. She's from a Jewish family in Israel. And there's a famine in the land, so there's no food. Now, and I've given months ago, or maybe a couple of years ago, I gave some of you a memory device about how you can remember Naomi's husband's name. You may still remember that, but just in case you've forgotten it, I don't think you would have, but and some of you might not have heard that yet. So here's how you can remember Naomi's husband's name. Elimelech, 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 Elimelech. You have outdone yourselves. And I'll bet you if I quizzed you 5 years from now, you'd still remember that. That's Elimelech. So it starts with Naomi and her husband Elimelech. And then they had two sons as well. But he had to find food for his family. And so they went to a different land. They went to a different country. They left Bethlehem, the name of which, by the way, means house of bread. Kind of ironic in this situation since there is no bread there because of the famine. And they leave to go to the country of Moab. It was a move motivated by survival because there was no food. So while they lived in Moab, the two sons grew old enough to marry. And because they were not in Israel, they didn't marry Jewish women. They married some Moabitesses. They just call them Moabites in the modern translations, and it's easier to say. Their season of survival is going smoothly enough until, bum, 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 disaster strikes. Not only does Elimelech pass away, but Naomi loses her two sons as well, both of them. So now she is this widow in a foreign land with no way to make any money, and she's got two daughters-in-law. How is she going to possibly provide for them? Kind of reminds me, unfortunately, of a prayer request that not too many weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, we were praying for some members of our own church family because they had a relative who had lost several relatives just in a very short period of time. Awful grief. So now we see Naomi, a grief-stricken widow, no husband, no sons, no way to provide for these two Moabite daughters-in-law. So what's she going to do? She's in no position to earn money. She's in dire straits. There are perils at every turn for her. But somehow word makes it all the way down from Israel to Naomi, and she finds out that things are starting to get a little bit better food-wise back up in Bethlehem. So she says, start packing, girls. And they start packing because they're going to get ready to take a journey and go back up to Bethlehem so they can find some food. Hopefully, maybe, somehow, they'll find a way to make a living back up there, because at least she knows friends and some of those folks back where she was from. But during the very beginning of the journey, just as they're starting out, Naomi starts to have second thoughts about bringing her two daughters-in-law with her. And she says, you know, girls, I think you should just go on back to Moab. She says, for one thing, I'm getting too old to have some more sons for you to be able to marry. And the way she says it, I kind of think there's a little facetiousness going on there. I mean, it was true, but she was giving a truth in a way that was basically saying it's absurd. There's no way that you're going to find any kind of persons to marry. And so you probably would find some among your own people. So you need to stay in Moab. Now, the story doesn't go into a lot of detail about the reasons why Naomi chose to send them back or try to send them back to Moab. But there could be several. Just logically. First, a journey like that in those days, no man to protect them. There were bandits. It was a dangerous trip. She might have thought, I don't want to put those two young ladies in jeopardy. But what that means is she was also willing to make that journey all by herself, which was very selfless. Second, since the Moabite women had come from a country that worshiped different gods, there's a whole different religious background, religious culture for them. She wasn't sure, probably in her mind, she's thinking, how are they going to get accepted, or will they be accepted back where I'm from in Bethlehem? These are Moabitesses. So she wasn't sure. Third, because the Moabite women were still young enough, there's the whole thing about marriage, and she's thinking you'll find much better chance of getting married back in Moab than you would if you come up to Israel. So one of the two girls decides, yeah, I think you're probably right, mother-in-law. Thank you for that. And so one of them decides to go on back to Moab. And tearfully, they say their goodbyes, and she heads back there. But Ruth decides to go with Naomi. She clings to Naomi, and she goes, don't beg me to leave you. And then she says what appears on a lot of greeting cards at Mother's Day. It's something that many of you have probably heard before, and it's the famous line, Ruth 1:16, where you go, I will go. Where you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And the last part of that phrase becomes very important in our story, especially as we start looking ahead to parts 2 and 3 of the spoiler alert. Now, I wish we had more details. If I'm reading a good novel, I want them to go into the details so I can smell what they're smelling and taste what they're tasting. But this one doesn't give us any details about their journey back up there. It just fast forwards. It's like, and now chapter 2. Oh, they're in Bethlehem. So we know at least they made it safely. They arrived there, and a couple of the women that knew Naomi from before says, is this really Naomi? But catch this. Because of their desperate situation, Naomi is beyond sad. She is really melancholic at that point. And she says, don't even call me Naomi. Call me Mara, which means sad or bitter, because the Almighty has made my life very sad. I mean, it sounds pretty dramatic, but that's the way she felt. And so she said, don't even call me by my regular name. And this is probably a good place to hit the pause button for a moment. Mothers, you know that you go through all kinds of seasons, some of which include sadness and grief, because there are transitions in life and passages that are going to require leaving some things behind, and that becomes reasons to be melancholic. Sometimes those things happen. I mean, there's the squishy baby season. We are fortunate because we are growing our church from the nursery up, and currently, because the Hermans are not quite ready to add to that number yet, but very close, and we're so glad you're here on Mother's Day. But the Adams have just recently had a cute little baby, and she's still in that squishy baby mode. And even though there's a tiny little bitty perfectly formed feet, they're really long, which means she's probably going to be a track star. And you just love because they'll snuggle so well right up here on your hand, up next to your neck. And when you smell that little baby head, especially after a bath, isn't there something different about a baby smell? I mean, oh. And so then you start to say goodbye to that baby face because there's the first haircut. Oh, man. And you can see moms that are crying a lot more than the kid when they're sitting on that booster seat in the barber's chair because you say, I don't want to cut those curls off. And so the curls start falling to the floor, and it's just an ordeal. Because there are passages that create grief. And then, of course, there's the defiant stage. And you're kind of really hoping that stage might actually pass. You know, the terrible twos. That's a terrible thing for people to lay on people, because some two-year-olds are probably really kind. I've never met one, but some are probably... there are probably some that are really kind and compliant at age two. And then you get to the, I met a guy stage. Sometimes that happens before graduations. Sometimes it happens after graduations. But, you know, it's the I met a guy stage. And hopefully his name is not Spike. And then there's the I'm graduating and now we want you to be present at my wedding. And then you get to be the grandma and you get to be in the hospital when that next grandchild is born. Then you get back into the squishy baby phase, but it's not your own, which is a lot easier in many respects. But there are all these different passages. And so, moms, a lot of you, I know, have gone through some seasons that have been just awfully, terribly grief-stricken. I know you have been. It comes with the territory. And there's sometimes it's cause for doubt. Sometimes we doubt whether God sees us in that plight, and we wonder, do you really see what's going on, and are you going to do something about that? That's where Naomi was. She was in dire straits. Have you personally known some grief that has caused you to actually have some doubts to say, I'm just not sure. I'm not sure what I feel about God or how I feel about Him because I'm not sure how He feels about me right now. And sometimes we could get into a discussion, this is for another time, but we could get into a discussion about whether God causes things to happen or if He allows them to happen. But frankly, I think it doesn't matter when you're in deep grief like that. It didn't matter to Naomi. If He caused it, great, that's what she says. She laid the blame squarely on God's shoulders. But if He allowed it, isn't that really tantamount? Isn't that the same thing to having caused it? Well, if He allowed it, even for His good purposes, I'm still going through it, so it's still God's fault. And when we're grieving, we need somebody to blame. That's a human condition, and Naomi did too, and so she just lays this one on God. Here's a thought, though. The right kind of doubts, I think this is a theologically correct thought, the right kind of doubts, even when we're in a time of grief, can actually help us build a stronger faith. Check out this quote from Charles Wellington. Faith without appropriate doubt is similar to a body without antibodies. An infusion of small doses of doubt can, in fact, build up a robust faith, a faith immune to the more deadly doubts. Do you see the analogy going on there? I've told you in detail months past about Gordon's season of doubt. I'll give you the one-minute version. He was a 19-year-old pre-law student, traveled from his hometown to a university. He was filled with sadness and doubt and anger. His older brother had been the fair-haired child of the family. He was the track star at school. Everybody loved him. He was the one voted to be the most successful when he grew up. And by the time Gordon got to school, his brother was dead. From tragic, awful, grief-stricken circumstances. So with that kind of loss in his past, recent past, Gordon had lots of questions and lots of doubts, and he started looking in lots of different places, trying to find some kind of truth that would help him latch onto something that would help him make sense of this tragedy. And in his season of doubt, he was thinking, well, how could a loving God allow this to happen to a church-going family like mine? Is there really even a God? Does God actually exist? So he was asking the big questions of life, and he was asking by seeking many different religious backgrounds, their people, what do you think? What do you think? What's your view of life? What's your worldview? Gratefully, his doubts propelled him to questions which finally led him to truth, and that truth was found in Jesus Christ. And gratefully, in my life, he caught up with me just recently, and we had a phone conversation that lasted a long time. And after 50 years, because this year marks 50 years of the beginning of that awful journey of his, after 50 years, he's still clinging to that wonderful faith on that rock-solid foundation of Jesus Christ. He ran to the strong tower, and he was saved. I'm very grateful for that. Sometimes those doubts can propel us in the right direction so that our faith can be built up. C.S. Lewis even says this about pain, which is part of grief. We can ignore pleasure, but pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And I think that in Naomi's case, her pain became a megaphone for God to be able to shout to her. And if we look at the rest of the story and see some of the circumstances that God arranges, he shouted to her. Meanwhile, back in Bethlehem, this part of the story where it gets really good. Do you want some more, by the way? Okay, good. Good for you. Yes. This could be filed under the file titled, God Works in Mysterious Ways, because he certainly does. There's an unexpected provision in a very unexpected manner right here in this portion of her story. Because Naomi and Ruth are hungry, they've got to eat something. Ruth decides she's going to go out to glean in the fields. Now, this would be roughly an equivalent of dumpster diving in our culture, except that they weren't really rummaging through trash. They were just trying to pick up loose grain that was left behind the harvester. So it was a lot cleaner than dumpster diving would be today. Plus, they didn't have dumpsters back then, so, you know. But it's what poor people did. I think that's where the connection is made. That's the only thing that poor people had at their disposal. They just had to pick up a few grains and take it back home and hope that they had enough to make a little pita bread or something. So Naomi and Ruth had arrived, gratefully, back in Bethlehem just as the start of the barley season had begun. And so Ruth goes out and starts gleaning in the fields. Here's one of the most amazing parts of Ruth's story. She starts gleaning in the field that happened to belong to a man. Now, she did not know that. It didn't say. She looked up on her GPS and said, oh, he's in my contacts list. Look, there's Boaz's field. And I can get to it with 7 minutes if I take this path. She didn't know where she was going. She wound up there. Do you think that's providence? Man, I think so. The field belonged to a guy named Boaz, whose name means strength is within him. And Boaz, as it turns out, according to the Israelite law, could possibly become Ruth's kinsman redeemer. Now, if you were to read through the book of Ruth, you'll see that this, from this point forward, you get to see that term redeemed or redeemer popping up again and again and again. One scholar said he counted its derivative, either the word itself or derivative of that word, 25 times within just the next couple of chapters. So does that give you a clue about what this book is about? So Naomi made the connection after Ruth had had that day of gleaning in the field, because it's basically the conversation would have gone something like, so how was your day, dear? Oh, it was pretty good. Well, what happened? Well, I was gleaning, and this really nice guy, you met a guy? Yeah, he was a very nice man. What's his name? Oh, well, his name is Boaz. What? Boaz? He said, yeah, he must have told his workers to allow me to start gleaning around some of the cut stalks of grain rather than having to stay over near the edges. And I saw them kind of leave some full heads of grain, dropping them. I think they were doing that on purpose, quite frankly. And Boaz even invited me to eat with the workers and him at the end of the day. And look at Ruth 2, verse 20. You can hear the excitement in Naomi's voice. The Lord bless him, she says. He continues to be kind to us, both the living and the dead. That becomes important, by the way. Why would she say that? You're going to see why. Then Naomi told Ruth, Boaz is one of our close relatives, one who should take care of us. Means the kinsman redeemer. Now, do you notice a significant shift in the tone in this verse compared with, don't even call me Naomi. Call me bitter. And now she's going, praise God, look at this. Look at what he's doing for us. He's taking care of the living and the dead. Naomi's statement signals a shift in attitude, because once Naomi realizes that God may in fact be providing for her in a miraculous way through this kinsman redeemer, everything changes. Now there's hope. Now there's the possibility of a family and a future. A kinsman redeemer provides family. And you might think, oh, wait a minute, did you leave a word out there? Aren't you supposed to say a kinsman redeemer provides for a family? Yeah. Let's go with that. We can do that. But he also provides family. Not only does he provide for a family, but he can also provide a family. Let me explain why. This term was used for somebody who was a near relative to someone who has passed away. And in this case, that person was Elimelech. Okay, good for you. Naomi's husband. You're getting there. All right. As a kinsman redeemer, Boaz could buy out the property that once belonged to the deceased relative. So he could have bought that out, not only from Elimelech, but also from the two sons. If they had been living, he would not have been able to do that, because in this case, the sons died as well. There was nobody else to do it, and so he could have bought everything out that would have belonged to him that can't be owned by the woman back in that culture. And that way, it allows Naomi to suddenly have a way to have a life. It would have been a huge blessing to Naomi, and consequently to Ruth. But that's not all Boaz is able to do because of the Israelite laws back then. Boaz is also not only providing for Naomi, but he's also able to choose Ruth as a bride. So he chooses to do this for these two women so that they'll have food, a family, and a future. Fantastic. In chapters 3 and 4, we see a little switchback that pops up in the road that we hadn't anticipated. It's like in every good drama, you have to have something that starts to take you off track and make you think, oh no, is this not going to work out? Because Boaz realizes that there's another relative in Bethlehem who's slightly closer in the lineage to Elimelech than he is. So he wisely negotiates with this guy at the city gate, which is the way they would kind of go to court, because they would have the elders that would gather at the gate. He would plead his case. He would talk to the guy, and then he would make a proclamation to say, this is my pledge, or this is my promise, my covenant. This becomes the binding agreement in front of them. And so this is what he does to them. And the guy kindly passes on saying, oh, I have to take Ruth as my wife if I do this? Okay, I'm going to pass. Thank you. Because he recognizes that could jeopardize his own family name and things that he's going to pass along. And so Boaz is going, okay, that worked out the way I wanted to. So then he makes this proclamation in verses 9 and 10 of Ruth 4. He says, I am buying from Naomi everything that belonged to Elimelech and those two sons, Chilion and Mahlon. I'm also taking Ruth, the Moabite, who was the wife of Mahlon, as my wife. I'm doing this so her dead husband's property will stay in his name, and his name will not be separated from his family and his hometown. That becomes crucial in parts 2 and 3 of my spoiler alert. From all the pain and the loss and the grief and the doubt, Naomi and Ruth have traveled back to the place of bread, the land of bread, the house of bread, where God provides not only literal food for them for a time, He provides a way to continue the family name for generations to come. Incredible. So what is Ruth's story about? That's always what we want to ask. What's the story about? How does it fit into the big picture of the Bible? And how does it point to the gospel? And that's what we see here. First of all, it's about pain that can lead people to see God's grace, because pain is God's megaphone. It shows us His provision, His redemption, in His timing and in His way, which always blows us away. Because when He does it, we can't take credit for it. When we see God working in a way that's clearly God at work, we have to say, man, that's a God thing. I could never possibly take credit for that. So we can trust a gracious God like that to see us through seasons of loss and grief. We can trust Him because He's in charge of everything. And He can make all things turn out good for those who love Him and who are called according to His purpose. It's also about a woman, Ruth, who just kept doing the right thing, even when the going got tough. She's a great example, moms, for you, because sometimes it's hard to keep doing the right thing. It's hard to keep loving that child and telling them the truth at the same time when you just like to chuck them out the window. I remember one time, no, I shouldn't say this. But tell the story. Nope, you better not. But I'm gonna listen to the angel. I'm not going to tell the story. God also provides for Israel. The way God orchestrated the events in Ruth's life, He also provided for something that would redeem Israel when they were desperate as well. And you think, how in the world did that happen? Well, I'm about to tell you. The son born to Boaz, are you ready for this? This is going to blow you away. Are you ready to be blown away? Okay. The son born to Boaz and Ruth becomes the grandfather of David, who becomes king of Israel. And the last thing we read in the book of Judges that Mark taught us about some time ago is that Israel needed a king at that point in their history. At that time in Israel's history, all the people there were doing what was right in their own eyes. And they desperately needed leadership, godly leadership, somebody who would point them in the way of righteousness with a strong hand. And through Ruth's descendants, through that lineage, the name of which would still be intact because of their laws and the way the kinsman redeemer worked, boom, God provides for that. Isn't that amazing? And if you back up all the steps that needed to happen for that, you can even praise God for a famine. Who would have thought? Who would have thought we could look back and say, God, I hated that pandemic. It was awful. I never want to go through a pandemic again because it just tore me up. And we can say, God, I can start to see evidence that you were at work even back then, lining things up so that certain things would take place right here. And it's bringing you glory and it's drawing people to faith in Christ. Thank you for a pandemic. Never thought I'd be saying that. It happens. Moms, when your kids go through stuff, there are certain things that you think, man, I don't ever want to have to go through that kind of season again. I pray that you'll have the courage to see it through and watch to see how God will work good out of those situations so that one day you can look back and say, okay, I'm actually grateful that that happened in our life, because if that hadn't happened, this would not be taking place right now. Thank you, God, that you see everything for my kids, even the stuff that causes me to get a lot more gray hair. But wait, there's even more. Do you want to hear more? Okay. Here's where Ruth's story and Israel's story points to our story. He provided for us as well. This story is not just about Ruth and her Redeemer, or Israel and its Redeemer. It's about our Redeemer too. Because of Ruth's heartwarming story, which gratefully has a really happy ending, God sets up a lineage that leads all the way from Ruth and her kinsman Redeemer to our own kinsman Redeemer, Jesus Christ. Ruth, a Moabite widow, an outsider, somebody that the Israelites didn't really even like much of the time, becomes part of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. She didn't know a thing about that at the time, obviously. If she could look back at that, she'd be amazed to know how God worked in that situation. It happened well into the future. Moms, that means that you don't know the future that God has for your kids. Are there times when you think, oh, Lord, I need some intervention? I don't know what's going to happen with this kid of mine. And you're pulling your hair out, and you're praying, and sometimes you're on your knees, and sometimes you can't go to sleep at night because you're just worrying with these things about your child that you're so concerned about. You can trust that God will answer prayers in His good time, that someday He's going to bring about some good things, maybe even in generations to come. Who knows what your great-grandchildren might experience? If you keep showing them the way to Christ and living the way that Ruth lived by saying, your God will be my God. Keep clinging to the God you know who's the strong tower. Run to Him in those times. Keep praying. Get on your knees before God by their bedsides. Keep praying for Him and with them, and God can turn things for His good over time. We also see something that's good for us because an outsider becomes a family member. Ruth, who was first seen as a foreigner, an outsider, a stranger when she left her home country to get up into Israel, she became a cherished member of God's family, including her Jewish family. She was grafted in, so to speak. And that's the same thing with we Gentiles. We can be grafted into God's family as well. She said to Naomi, back when they were getting ready to leave, your God will be my God. What a great statement. That changed everything, not only for her, but for Israel and now for us. Ruth's story points to Jesus, and that's where we see the gospel. Jesus, who came to earth and became one of us, made a way to redeem us. He took our place on the cross. He made a way for us to become one of His own children, to become part of His family, because we're covered by His blood. And it doesn't matter if we're outsiders, even though we are outsiders because of sin, going all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Sin made them outsiders. And all of us are outsiders if we have sin in our life that hasn't been dealt with. But He wants to make us insiders and bring us into His family. How did He do that? Through Jesus Christ. And many people, I'm afraid, don't feel like they belong. They don't even feel comfortable in their own skin, much less comfortable with their own family. I remember a pastor friend of mine said that there was a woman in his church. She was in her 70s, and she remembers painfully that she overheard her mom saying when she was a kid, "Oh, she was unwanted. I didn't want that kid." And she said, I clung to that and lived with that my whole life until I realized that God knew me before I was born. And he was my kinsman redeemer. And he wants to redeem me and bring me into his family. And she said, that was a life-shattering, in a good way, event for me. And it changed the way I see life and my future. And I want to be a part of God's family for the rest of eternity, thanks to that. Sadly, there are just so many today that just don't feel comfortable. They don't feel like they belong. If you are one of those persons, or if you know somebody who is, I got to tell you, you'll belong with God. He's got a place for you. He wants you to become a part of that family. And all you have to do is admit, oh, he is my kinsman redeemer. I get that. What he did for me makes it possible. I want to trust him. Jesus, our kinsman redeemer, paid the redemption price. And he can draw us into his family. Since then, since this story took place, generations of people have trusted him. It's still going on today. You can become part of that too if you have not yet trusted him. Let me say a prayer that you could model and say silently even in your own heart if you would like to begin that journey. It could be something simple just like this. God, I have felt at times like an outsider, and I've had doubts, and I've had loss and grief. But in this story, I see a kinsman redeemer in Jesus Christ, and I want him to redeem me. Please forgive me of my sins. Thank you for forgiving me and inviting me into your family and placing me with millions of other believers. I want that. I want to be a part of your family so that I can start to get to know you better and better. Come into my heart and life. I put my full trust in you, and I want to follow you for the rest of my days on earth and all the way into eternity, because I know you're preparing a place for me there as well. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. And folks, if you know somebody who needs to hear a prayer like that, you can help guide them in that way as well, because it's not just the pastors who have that ability. And I'm grateful that there were people in my life who were not pastors who were able to share that kind of information, because gratefully, I became a believer way back when because of caring people in my life through that family of faith. I'm glad you're part of the family of faith. And I pray God's blessings on you. And let's lift up the Lord in worship as we go out today.